You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us. Hi, I'm Annie from the US.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast. Before we start, I would love to say thank you to Devon for your absolutely lovely message. I love the frog thing. My mom calls me frog ever since I was a baby, so it's a huge thing in my family as well. Devon, if you want to send us the whole story for our Halloween episode, we would love to hear more about it.
Yeah, please do. I really loved that story. I collect frog stuff too and have been called frog by my mom since I was little. So that's why I was surprised by that. Thank you so much for that story. And thank you to everyone on Patreon and everyone supporting us. If you want to know more, just listen to the end, please. I'm really sorry that we weren't here last week. If you're on our socials, long story short, I had to have some dental surgery because I am now an old lady. And it was not fun, but I'm feeling much better. Thank you, everybody, for your very, very kind words.
I've got implants and a crown, which is not how I wanted it to go specifically.
Today, I thought it's time that you learn a bit more about my beautiful, teeny tiny home country of Austria. Well, actually, you learned and heard a lot from me over the years already. Well, you learned the truth about Krampus. You learned how the Stephansdom was built and how riding a cock was somehow involved. You heard tragic stories about the Habsburg family, where to encounter ghosts in Vienna. And you all know by now that we not only waltz into the new year, but also into battle. Almost, kind of.
I like that about the Austrian people, waltzing into anything, a waltz into danger.
And I thought now it's time to hear a couple of our most famous sagen, which are folk legends.
I can't wait for this. I'm ready.
So what are sagen? Well, the very simple explanation is that sagen is a German term that translates to legends or folk tales in English. Even though in German we distinguish between Sagen and Legenden.
Oh, so sagas and legend. Yeah.
Like one is for saints. The Legenden is always about saints, basically. Ah. And yeah, well, that's going into too much detail, but just a fun fact.
Got it.
That translates, as I said, to legends or folk tales in English. And these are traditional stories passed down orally through generations, often involving supernatural or mythical elements. And of course, I know they do not only exist in German-speaking countries. They're an integral part of many cultures. And they were used to explain natural phenomena, teach moral lessons, or simply entertain. Germany in particular, but also Austria, Switzerland, has a rich tradition of sagen with countless stories varying from region to region. And we already talked a bit about it in our episode about fairy tales. While both sagen and märchen, so fairy tales, are forms of folklore in German culture, they differ in their grounding in reality, thematic content, and narrative style. Sagen tend to be more rooted in historical or cultural contexts and often convey moral or explanatory messages, whereas Märchen, so fairy tales, are characterized by their fantastical elements, archetypal characters, and timeless appeal. On the other hand, you'll find the German Sagen, a treasure of legends passed down through generations that hold a very unique position in the cultural landscape of Austria, Germany, and Switzerland. The term derived from the German word for saying, so Sagen also means to say in German. And in general, we distinguish between three different forms of Sagen. We have Göttersagen, Heldensagen, and Volkssagen. So Göttersagen are the myth of the gods. And they delve into the mystical realm of Germanic mythology where gods and goddesses reign supreme. These tales, rooted in ancient beliefs, recount the recreation of the world and the epic struggles between divine beings and cosmic forces. Themes of power, fate, and wisdom permeate these myths, offering glimpses into the religious practices and cosmological worldview of early Germanic societies. From creation of the world, from the body of the giant Ymir to the exploits of Thor and Odin, Göttersagen illuminate the spiritual and mythological heritage of the German people. I mean, we all know that also from ancient Greece or from the Romans. It's the same everywhere, right?
Right.
Then we have the Heldensagen, the heroic legends. They celebrate the valor and heroism of legendary figures who undertake epic quests and face formidable challenges. These tales, often blending history with myth, exalt virtues such as courage, honor, and self-sacrifice. Heroes like Siegfried in the Nibelungenlied embody ideals of bravery and chivalry, inspiring admiration and awe across generations. The Heldensagen serve as cultural touchstones, preserving the memory of legendary deeds and the enduring appeal of heroic ideals. Of course, again, many other cultures have their own Heldensagen. I would say Hercules is a heroic legend, or Beowulf, or King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table, for example.
Yeah.
Amidst the grandeur of gods and heroes, Volkssagen, or folk legends, or folk tales, offer a more grounded perspective, and they are rooted in the everyday lives and beliefs of ordinary people. Passed down orally within communities, these tales feature common characters and settings, making them very relatable to the general population. Volkssagen encompass a wide range of themes, from love and betrayal to trickery and justice, often incorporating supernatural elements like, for example, the devil, to explain natural phenomena or provide moral lessons. These stories, whether about ghosts haunting old castles or witches casting spells on unsuspecting villagers, reflect the rich tapestry of German folklore and cultural heritage. Of course, this classification of Sagen, so the division between Göttersagen, Heldensagen, Volkssagen, is not without its complexities, but I won't go into detail there. I don't want to bore you to death.
I don't think any of it's boring. It's just you could do a PhD on this topic.
Yeah,
and
it's a lot. Yeah. At the heart of many sagen lies a curious blend of reality and superstition. Rooted in the natural landscape and local customs, these tales often serve as explanations for the inexplicable, weaving together elements of folklore and myth to make sense of the world. For example, local legends frequently emerge from peculiar natural formations or historical landmarks, whether it be strange rock formations, eerie mists, or ancient ruins. These elements serve as the backdrop for stories of ghosts, spirits, and otherworldly beings. Again, here it's very often the devil who's responsible for weird rock formations and things like this.
I mean, there are a lot of rock formations named after the devil. A lot.
I think you have the same, right?
Yes. All over the world, I think. I've been to Hell's whatever in all over the world. Hell's outcropping.
Yeah, and whenever there's like a weird dent in one rock somewhere up the hill, then it's like the devil's footprint or things
like
this,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Anyway, I thought it would be fun for you if in this episode I would read to you some of the creepiest, funniest, and maybe most interesting, or at least to me most interesting, Austrian folk tales.
Yeah.
I try to translate the originals to best of my knowledge, and I hope it all makes sense.
I can't wait.
And I have to say, we are a teeny tiny country, but we have 9 different states. But not only every state, every region in every state has their own folk taste, their own dialect, their own way of talking, their own kinds of traditions and cultural events. So it's funny, we're just 9 million people, but there is still a lot of diversity. I'd say let's start in Vienna. And this one is a beautiful example for how Sagen were used to tell stories about historical events. In the case of our first legend, one of the times the plague terrorized Europe. And I know I talked about it before, I guess several times.
We like the plague.
I still want to do a whole episode about that.
Yeah.
We like the plague.
We're
so
into
interesting.
The plague. Yeah.
So this is about the devastating outbreak of 1679. And that was a significant event in the city's history and known as the Great Plague of Vienna. It was one of the deadliest epidemics to strike the Austrian capital. The outbreak of 1679 was part of a larger pandemic that swept across Europe during the time, claiming millions of lives. In Vienna, the plague spread rapidly, leading to widespread panic and devastation. The disease, most likely bubonic plague, caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis, was transmitted through fleas infesting rats and could also spread from person to person to person through respiratory droplets. Based on contemporary records, 7,000 plague victims are identifiable, but the total number of deaths in Vienna is estimated to be between 12,000 and 15,000. Estimates, which also include deaths in the surrounding area of Vienna, range from 30,000 to 50,000. Contemporary reports are often speaking of up to 140,000 deaths, and most historians agree that this is certainly exaggerated, but I think it shows how devastating and overbearing the whole outbreak appeared to be in the mind of people who lived through it. There were piles of bodies that had to be transported away and put into mass graves.
Right.
The plague had profound social, economic, and cultural consequences for Vienna. Entire neighborhoods were quarantined, and measures such as mass burials and the burning of infected houses were implemented to try to contain the spread of the disease. And we all know that in medieval times and later on, I mean, this was 1679, the hygienic standards in European cities wasn't that great, right?
No.
Small streets, cobblestone streets or dirt streets even. No sanitation, nothing, and people were living very close to each other. So yeah, it spread. It spread like fire in those cities would spread. So as I said, the Great Plague of Vienna left a lasting impact on the city's psyche and infrastructure, and it also led to changes in public health policies, such as improved sanitation and quarantine measures that were aimed at preventing future outbreaks. The epidemic also influenced art, literature, and religious practices, with many artists and writers depicting scenes of suffering and death in their works.
I think that's one thing that's changed a lot about how humanity experiences plagues in a way, because back then, or during the influenza outbreak, for example, it was very much a situation where everybody was living with the illness, right? People, you had your family at home, you were caring for them, you were watching all of your loved ones die. Whereas today, when we have these mass casualty events, it's kind of removed because everyone's taken away. And that's its own terrifying thing, right? Having loved ones that you can't get to in the hospital, but it also kind of removes that aspect of it from our social consciousness in some ways, in some countries.
We live more removed than, as you said, in some countries, like definitely here in most European countries, in the US, in Canada, we are very removed from sickness and death.
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah.
Anyway, Vienna eventually recovered and continued to thrive as a cultural and economic center. However, of course, the memory of the Great Plague remained etched in the city's collective memory, and it was serving as a reminder of the fragility of human life and the importance of public health measures in combating infectious diseases. And to this day, here in Vienna, we are still talking about the Lieben Augustin. So the story of Marcus or Max Augustin is a well-known legend in Vienna. Augustin, also known as der Liebe Augustin or Dear Augustin, was, according to legend, a popular folk figure who lived during the 17th century, so exactly at the time when the Great Plague of Vienna was happening. The legend recounts the tale of Augustin's misadventures during the Great Plague. The story goes something like this. Augustin was a bagpiper and entertainer who frequented the taverns and streets of Vienna, and he was charming audiences with his music and humor. However, during the plague, Augustin's life took a very dramatic turn. One version of the story goes as follows. During the height of the plague, Augustin, in a drunken stupor, collapsed in the street and fell asleep. Mistaken for dead by plague attendants, he was thrown onto a cart with other deceased victims and taken to a mass burial site outside the city of Vienna. As the bodies were being dumped into a pit, Augustin woke up, realizing his dire situation, and in a panic, he struggled to climb out of the pit, but was unable to escape on his own.
Oh no. So he's just down there and he's just all, I'm not dead yet.
Yeah.
That's all I can think of is that Monty Python. Bring out, you're dead. I'm not dead yet. I feel happy. This is awful.
It's so awful. Eventually, as daylight broke, the workers returned to the pit and discovered Augustin among the bodies. They helped him out of the grave, astonished to find him alive. And despite his ordeal, Augustin survived the plague and went on to recount his harrowing experience, becoming a legendary figure in Viennese folklore. We even have a song about the Liebe Augustin.
Nice.
The story of Augustin serves as a cautionary tale. Don't fall asleep drunk in the street, especially during the plague, please. It's a cautionary tale about the unpredictability and horrors of the plague, as well as a testament to the resilience of the human spirit, because he was always in a good mood, even after they pulled him out of the mass grave.
Nice.
He wasn't traumatized, apparently.
Good for him.
Today, Augustine is remembered through various cultural references, including songs, poems, and sculptures, as a symbol of survival and endurance in the face of hardship. Annie, can you imagine when the undertakers came back the next morning and one of the plague victims has been brought back to life? I just have to imagine them going back home after work. So they return home that day and they're telling their loved ones, their family, the tale of an undead. Like, ooh.
Yeah.
Zombie.
Yeah.
The first zombie tale.
And don't you think he's lucky that it happened like pre-zombie genre era? Because I feel like many people who came back from the dead, seemingly, like he would have just been immediately shot in the head today. It's like, what's happening here,
well,
Bang?
They could have mistaken him for a vampire.
Yeah. Staked, beheaded. I just feel like he was very lucky. This is amazing.
I think his luck was also that he was well known in Vienna.
Yes, people knew him and recognized him.
Yeah, I guess. Also, what's maybe an interesting fact for some, in Vienna, there's a magazine called Augustine, and it's sold by unhoused people as means to support themselves. And you'll see the so-called Augustin-Verkäufer, so the Augustin seller, all over the city. They always have to have an ID that identifies them as an official Augustin salesperson. And the fact that the magazine is named after the lieben Augustin is another sign of how much his legend still lives on in the city to this day.
That's a nice legacy to have.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
I mean, he's probably not real, but still.
Still. There's no reason somebody couldn't have... This could have happened.
I'm pretty sure that happened.
This isn't
yeah,
a
definitely.
Crazy story.
The next one might be something to your liking, Annie.
Right.
We also have quite some stories about cryptozoology.
Mm. I love cryptozoology.
Most famous among those, the basilisk at the Schönen Laternengasse. How do you say basilisk in English? Basilisk?
Basilisk. Yeah, so I think you're okay either way there.
So a basilisk or basilisk is a mythical creature often described as a serpent or dragon with the ability to kill with its gaze or breath. In European folklore, it is often depicted as a serpent with a crown-like crest on its head. And according to legend, its stare or breath is lethal, capable of causing death or petrification. And if you watched Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, then you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Your best bet is to go and fight a basilisk with a mirror.
Yes. Everyone knows that now. That's Basilisk 101. Come on.
So this is how the story goes. On the morning of 26th of June 1212.
That's a very specific date. Sorry for that time. I just want to...
That's so weird, right?
As a historical researchers that we've become, we have to say, that's rare. This must be some event. All right, I'm ready.
There was quite a commotion in the house of a baker in the part of the city then known as Unterm Tempelhof, now called Schön Laterngasse. First of all, I have the feeling, let me pause here real quick. I have the feeling we talked about the area called Unterm Tempel when we talked about, oh my God, what is her name? The woman who carried Theresia Kandel, who carried her husband that she murdered in the wicker basket through the city. Yeah. Also, I really want to tell you that the Schön Laterngasse is one of those streets that you picture when you think of old European cities. It's a charming and historic street located in the heart of Vienna. The Schön Laterngasse is situated in the first or so-called inner district. The street is known for its quaint cobblestone pathways, which add to its very romantic ambience, and it transports visitors back in time 100%. And as you stroll along Schön Laterngasse, you'll encounter a variety of shops, cafes, and restaurants tucked away in the historic buildings, offering a very delightful mix of not-so-traditional Viennese fare and artisanal goods.
Can we go there when we don't meet?
We absolutely will, of course. I'm going to show you the Basilisk House.
Yes.
Why is it called Schön Laterngasse?
That was my next question.
Well, Schön Latern translates to beautiful lantern, and the street is home to the Schön Laterngassen Laterne, the Schön Laterngassen Lantern. And this is a very old historic lantern adorned with intricate metalwork.
Oh, it's right up my dark and creepy street. You know how much I love old lamps.
Also, visitors can explore very charming courtyards and hidden passageways, by the way. I don't know if you know, but Vienna, as most European cities, has so many hidden passageways, and I love them. I love them. My friend Ingrid from Hamburg once took a guided tour, and they explored many of those passageways, and I'm actually sure that she visited some that I didn't even know existed. So for everyone coming to Vienna, please visit the Schönlaterngasse and maybe book a tour of Vienna's passageways.
Yeah.
That's my tip for you. But back to the basilisk. So there's a commotion, loud shouting and clamoring, causing many curious folks to gather and inquire about the distressing noise. Eventually, the city judge arrived on horseback, asking if anyone had been harmed or threatened. I mean, those were the days when the judge came on horseback just because somebody was being loud.
You couldn't get on Facebook and be like, was that an earthquake? Like we do today. You had to get on your horse and ride out to wherever that screaming was coming from to figure out what was happening.
But it's the judge and not just some soldiers.
Yeah, that's how you know it was serious.
Continuing, the pale-faced baker stepped out and explained to the judge the cause of all the turmoil. One of his maids had gone out to the courtyard to draw water from the well, but she quickly returned in a panic, exclaiming that a dreadful stench was emanating from the well, nearly causing her to faint. She also claimed to have seen strange sparkling lights at the bottom of the well, terrifying her to the point of near death.
Okay. We're not judging.
One of the baker's apprentices laughed at the maid's fear and bravely volunteered to investigate the curious phenomenon. He was lowered into the well with a lit torch tied to a rope. However, as he descended a few fathoms, he let out a blood-curdling scream and was hastily pulled back up, barely conscious.
No.
Dun, dun, dun. After being revived, he recounted his harrowing experience. He had seen a hideous creature resembling a large rooster, but with grotesque features.
More grotesque than a rooster. Sorry.
Well, he had a multi-pointed scale-covered tail.
Aww.
Clumsy, wart-covered feet, peculiar, I love that they call it peculiar glowing eyes,
peculiar.
Not like threatening or creepy, it's peculiar, and yeah. A crown-like crest on its head.
Aww.
It seemed to him, so the apprentice, like a monstrous hybrid of a rooster, a toad, and a snake, the most repulsive thing he had ever seen. He immediately shut his eyes and screamed for help, feeling as though the creature's fiery gaze was freezing his blood and the noxious odor was suffocating him. He believed he would have perished had he not been quickly pulled out of the well. The people were astonished by his tale, unsure of what to do. A learned physician, knowledgeable in natural science, stepped forward and identified the creature as a basilisk, explaining that it was said to hatch from an egg laid by a rooster and incubated by a toad.
Wait, okay.
It's the impossible creature.
I see what's happening here. Carry on. Okay.
He recounted the writings of renowned Roman naturalist Plinius, who described the basilisk's deadly gaze, capable of killing anyone it fixed upon, and the only way to defeat it was to show it its own reflection in a polished metal mirror, causing it to die of a shock. I feel bad for the basilisk.
I do too.
However, he warned against attempting such a dangerous feat. With no one willing to undertake the perilous task, the city judge ordered a large stone and earth to be thrown into the well, crushing and destroying the creature. Sadly, the baker's apprentice passed away later that day. To commemorate the event, a faithful representation of the monstrous creature was placed in a niche of the house, accompanied by an inscription. So that's the story, and you can still see the statue and the inscription at Schönlaterngasse, house number 7. And I send you a picture.
All right, so I'm looking at the picture. Oh, okay, well... All right, now listen, no shade at the sculptor. Maybe it's been weather-worn. I don't know how long it's been there. It just looks like the sculpture looks like somebody took a lumpy baked potato. It looks like how when I used to try to make like swan-wrapped leftovers at the fancy restaurant but was not good at it. So this is kind of what it looked like. It just looks like some kind of I'm not sure what, but the painting of it. Let's talk about the painting of it, because the painting of it is amazing and 1000% something that today would wear a sweater and be famous on TikTok for getting tucked into bed at night. It's got chicken feet and like a rooster tail and a toad back. What's it holding? Does it look like it's holding something, or is it just clutching its fat belly, which is cute?
I think it's either clutching its belly or holding an egg, maybe.
Oh, it might be holding an egg. Hmm. I want that. I would dress it up in little sweaters and put it in a pram and take it around town. 1000%.
You're not taking our basilisk seriously, I see.
I'm not. I'm team basilisk. I feel bad for him. I like the basilisk. Aww. Oh, is this other picture the lantern?
That's the lantern,
it's
yeah.
It's so pretty.
Didn't you expect more of a lantern that's the lantern of Pretty Lantern Street?
No, I didn't. I think that's gorgeous.
Okay.
No, because it depends on the age of the thing. That's gorgeous. The lumpy chicken is not scary.
It really looks like a sad chicken.
It looks like if your kid made you. Your kid came home from school at Thanksgiving and was like, look, Mom, I made a turkey centerpiece. And you were like, great. I might have made something like this back in the day.
But it really looks just like a chicken. Where's the toad? Where's the snake?
I don't understand. I agree. It just looks like a sad chicken. It looks like a kind of a cross between a chicken and a seagull. Like the face isn't quite right for...
You know what probably happened? There were like some poisonous gas building in the well. That's the stench. And then a chicken fell down the well. And then the apprentice went down and saw the chicken and completely freaked out because he was like probably hallucinating or like in an LSD swamp.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking, did something just fall down the well, die, start to rot? And then everyone freaked out when it like floated to the surface. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Terrible stench, grotesque looking, unrecognizable thing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could just be some animal, just could be anything. Could be, I mean, literally anything.
Yeah. Ugh. Poor cheeky.
I know. If it was a basilisk, though, that looked like this thing right here, then I feel bad for it.
Anyway, Vienna is full of amazing sagen, and I could probably spend like 10 episodes or more just talking about them. But I'd say let's do one more from Vienna. And this is for all the wicked women out there who listen to our podcast. You're amazing. And apparently even the devil is scared of you. And this legend, folk legend, is called The Devil and the Bogner's Wife. Once upon a time, in the early 16th century, there lived a master bow maker named Kaspar Pergauer in Bognergasse, the heart of Vienna's arrow and bow craftsmen. Kaspar could have led a good life. His business flourished, he enjoyed his work, and his income was respectable. No wonder a modest prosperity settled in, allowing the diligent master to indulge in pleasures that others could only dream of. Moreover, he was a good-natured, honorable man who never harmed a fly and always lent a helping hand to friends and neighbors, earning everyone's goodwill. Everything would have been fine if not for his better half, who had a say in many matters. Do you say that actually in English? Because in German we have die bessere Hälfte, which refers to your partner.
Yes, your better half or your other half, or yes, definitely.
Okay.
From the way you're describing this, I'm not sure she is the better half. Maybe the other half.
I think that's, they are being sarcastically, in the 16th century. Kaspar's bride, Ursula, was a pretty girl when they married, and her thriftiness and domestic skills were admirable qualities. Though she had a sharp tongue and a knack for verbal sparring, Kaspar believed that with time she would mellow out or at least learn to apply her wit judiciously. So he ignored his friend's warnings about marrying Ursula, dismissing them as envy. Unfortunately, along with the harm Ursula inflicted, Kaspar had to endure the ridicule of his friends. It seemed that his wife's life's purpose was to make his existence a living hell.
No.
It began at dawn when she opened her eyes and persisted until late at night when sleep mercifully silenced her nagging, allowing Kaspar some rest.
Oh, no.
He endured her ceaseless complaints and criticism silently, but to no avail. No matter how quiet he remained, Ursula found no end to her tirades. As a result, Caspar grew sullen and disheartened, avoiding his friends to escape their teasing and finding no joy in his work. Where once merry tunes filled his workshop, now he moved about in silence, often lacking the motivation to work. Soon, his home became so notorious that no journeyman or maid would take service with him. One evening, driven to desperation by Ursula's relentless complaining, Caspar slammed the door behind him without a word and fled aimlessly through the streets until he found himself exhausted in St. Peter's Cemetery, leaning against a tombstone. "I can't bear this life any longer," he lamented. "The torment never ends, and no one can help me. Not even heaven takes a pity on my plight. I might as well call on the devil for assistance." Hardly had he uttered these words when a chilling laughter broke the silence of the cemetery, and in the pale moonlight stood a sinister, gloomy figure before the startled bowmaker, whose breath caught in his throat. Doesn't the devil have anything better to do than just eavesdropping on people?
Apparently not. A lot of free time, the devil. Who knew?
"Here I am. You've summoned me. You want to say the devil?"
"You want me to be the devil?"
"Yeah, you be okay. The devil."
"Here I am. You've summoned me,"
croaked the black one with a hoarse voice.
"What do you want from me? Speak."
As the master, unable to utter a word, merely extended his hands defensively, the devil added,
"You wish for me to teach your wife better manners, to turn the raging wolf into a docile lamb? Is that it?"
"Yes, if you could accomplish that," sighed Pergauer, regaining some composure.
"It would be pathetic if I couldn't,"
said the devil, puffing up his chest arrogantly.
"I'll make you a proposal. I'll tame your wife within 3 days, and then you may live happily with her. But at your death hour, I'll come to claim your soul. If, however, which is unlikely, I fail to make her meek and gentle as a dove within this time frame, you can call me the dumbest devil to tread the earth. Then the contract will be null and void, and I'll have no claim on your soul. You'll pay for your sins amply by continuing to live with such a woman."
Agreeing to the devil's terms, the master watched as the fiend disappeared as quickly as he had appeared. The next morning, the devil disguised as Pergauer appeared in the house on Bognergasse to begin taming the bowmaker's wife. Initially, he attempted to persuade her gently. Approaching her bed, he tried to wake her with a kiss. But as Ursula opened her eyes and saw her supposed husband, she sprang up as if stung by a wasp and unleashed a barrage of curses on the bewildered devil, whom she called a malicious intruder bent on ruining her life from daybreak. And so it went on and on throughout the day. Like a mill wheel, the harsh words of the shrewish woman turned without respite. When her anger peaked, she punctuated it with a few hearty slaps and punches. "That's not okay, woman."
Mm-mm.
The sound of a scuffle heard several times from the house indicated that even the face of the bemused Prince of Darkness did not escape unscathed. By the day's end, the poor devil could claim no success, only bruises and a black eye.
So, love isn't the answer in this case, you think?
The devil mused to himself, deciding to reason with the bogner's wife the next day. Indeed, in the morning it seemed like this approach might succeed. The woman listened calmly and the devil thought she might see reason. But at noon her mood suddenly changed. As the infernal tutor attempted to explain how unjust and inhumane her treatment of him was, Frau Ursula erupted in a fury and angrily accused him of patronizing her like a child. And in this manner the entire day went by. Every effort of the devil to appeal to reason was met with failure. Finally, she poured a pot of boiling soup over his head, causing him to flee out of the door to avoid further injury. Again, that's not okay, Frau Ursula.
No, no.
Returning sheepishly to the room sometime later, the devil found the enraged woman still unreconciled, and his attempt to reason with her once again failed. At last, she kicked him and kicked him out of the room.
Hellfire and brimstone. I can do better. Hellfire. Nope. I think we can make an excuse for the physical abuse because he is actually Satan.
Yeah, but she doesn't know that. And she treats her husband like that.
Well, this is true.
Well,
very good point. Okay. Hellfire and brimstone.
Cursed the mistreated Satan angrily to himself.
Am I to be outdone by this hot-tempered woman? That would be something.
Tomorrow I'll try force, and let's see if I can't tame this shrewish creature. She'll surely back down when she realizes she's up against the devil himself. That last bit was just dramatic. Yeah.
On the third day, he stood before Frau Ursula and spoke in a stern voice.
Listen. Sorry. Listen, woman. All attempts to change your mind with kindness, love, and reasonable words have been in vain. You haven't shed your contentiousness and malice. Now my patience is at an end. So I command you to change your ways thoroughly from now on. If you do not, you can expect the worst, and you will bitterly regret your stubbornness.
If the devil had thought that these stern words would strike fear into the heart of the Bogner's wife and achieve his goal, he was sorely mistaken. For now, the real battle began. What? She screamed, her eyes flashing. You helpless creature dare to threaten me and have the audacity to speak of your patience. You'll see that my patience has run out now. And she launched herself at the devil with such force that he was dumbfounded, unable to do anything but assume his true devilish form to defend himself against the raging woman. But Frau Ursula hesitated only for a moment before attacking the devil again, grabbing him by the horns and shaking him so vigorously that one horn broke off and remained in her hand. The devil, now beside himself, gave up the fight. Amidst the smell of brimstone and his hellish howls, he fled through the door, while the triumphant Bogner's wife waved the devil's horn she had left behind and shouted curses after him. So, while Kaspar Bergauer won his wager with the devil and saved his immortal soul, he lost his peace on earth once and for all. If not even the devil could convert the obstinate Bogner's wife, how could an ordinary human or poor Kaspar ever hope to? Thus, for many years he atoned for all his sins on earth by living alongside the woman who was worse than the devil himself and surely entered heaven after death. As for the Bogner's wife, history remained silent about her fate. Heaven was surely denied her, for in her lifetime she made her husband's life a living hell. But hell was also off limits to her, as the devil wanted nothing to do with her. So she may well still wander the earth in one form or another to this day, and many claim they have encountered her in life. As a perpetual reminder of the alteration between the Bogner's wife and the devil, a painting was later hung at Kaspar Bergauer's residence on Bognergasse 3, depicting that infamous quarrel. Beneath it were the significant verses, "Pestilence and need are a hardship, war a troublesome pastime, but worse than the devil's cunning and deceit, may God protect us, is a wicked wife."
I mean, yes, we all know that a wicked wife is worse than, you know, pestilence and war and Satan, for sure. You know what that story reminds me of a little bit, and I'm not sure why, but you know that? Is it a comic or a meme where it's like Dracula and then Dracula's turned into a bat and then Dracula, the bat, gets the brushy-brushy with the toothbrush? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you went to brushy-brushy. I just keep imagining Satan going in and being like, I'm going to handle this. And then he's like out like, nope. Just over and over again. Nope.
She broke off one of his horns. Can you imagine?
Good for her.
I wonder what she did with it.
I don't know. She just had enough. She was just sick and tired of everyone's nonsense. She'd had it.
Now, let's leave Vienna behind and move to Carinthia with another cryptozoology legend, the Lindwurm of Klagenfurt. A Lindwurm is a mythical creature from European folklore, often depicted as a wingless dragon or large serpent-like monster. Aww. It's typically described as having a thick body, powerful jaws with sharp teeth, and sometimes armored scales covering its skin. Lindwürmer were said to dwell in caves, marshes, or other secluded places, preying on livestock and occasionally humans. And this is the story of the Lindwurm in Klagenfurt, which, by the way, is the capital of the Austrian state of Carinthia.
All right.
And the story goes like this. Where Klagenfurt stands today, there used to be nothing but marshy wilderness. The few people living in the surrounding mountains avoided descending because poisonous mists crept over the swamp, sometimes even reaching up the slopes. This happened whenever the dragon living in the marsh below struck its head out, searching for prey and roaring hungrily. Can you imagine living somewhere where you hear a dragon roar from time to time because he needs feeding?
I'm trying to figure out what that would have been, because I, growing up on marshes, I'm like, well, is the poisonous gas just low tide? Is that what they thought? The smell of low tide, because anyone who's grown up by a marsh knows, like, a lot of people think it's a horrible, terrible smell, but the smell of marsh is very different from the smell of sewage, if you're familiar with both smells. But if you didn't know and you just smelled that, I don't know. What was the roaring?
Occasionally, a stray piece of livestock from the mountain pastures would wander into the wide, marshy valley where the lindworm lurked, but no shepherd there to retrieve the lost animal. For it was known from past times that the dragon not only devoured livestock, but also humans who ventured too close. Some shepherds and woodcutters who had dared to approach the swamp had never returned from the foggy, poisonous haze. When Duke Karast ruled from Kahnburg, his hunters wandering through the forests on the mountain slopes one day found traces of enormous paws, and from time to time a cow or a few sheep or goats even disappeared from the higher alpine meadows. That's when the people in the mountains knew that the voracious lindworm was growing ever more voracious and larger, and that what it caught in the swamp's edge was no longer enough. Its howling and smacking became louder and drew closer, while the people grew more frightened and hardly dared to leave their huts. Now the Duke hatched a plan to send armed men against the monster. He promised them high rewards and a piece of land. A few men volunteered, willing to descend to the swamp armed with lances and shields. From above, they could already see the lindworm grazing on the reed-covered bank. It had scales all over its body, a long, thick tail, glowing eyes, terrible teeth, that's mean, and occasionally spread two wings as if preparing to take flight. Now the men on the mountainside understood why lately even cows and mighty bulls had disappeared from the higher alpine meadows. Horrified, they fled back up into the mountains and reported to the Duke that the lindworm had become so powerful from its plunder that it could now fly. They all considered whether they should better leave their homeland and settle elsewhere. Then one said, "The dragon can fly, it will pursue us, we are lost." But another said, "Such a creature is voracious, but stupid. Perhaps we can outsmart it." Now even the most voracious lindworm sometimes sleeps. And the greedier it is and the more it has in its stomach, the longer it takes to digest its prey. The dragon retreated to sleep in the swamp and the men descended the slope, gathered stones and large boulders, built a kind of tower out of them, and waited. When they realized that the lindworm would soon awaken to snap up its prey again, they brought the fattest bull they had and tied it, as a bait, to the tower. But first, they had tied iron barbs to its horn. Then they hid inside the tower. Poor bull.
I know. Lindworm doesn't want to be fed. Lindworm wants to hunt.
As the bull began to bellow, the swamp moved and the lindworm shot out. Snorting and beating the water with its powerful wings and claws, it approached the bull and snapped at its head. But then it bit onto the barbs. The lindworm couldn't free itself. The men rushed out of the tower hideout and beat it to death with their weapons. Since then, there have been no dragons in the swampy area. The people came down from the mountains, cleared the wild brush, and built huts and houses for themselves. Since then, the Klagenfurt Basin had been inhabited. In Klagenfurt, a large stone lindworm stands in memory of the dragon era, and the city of Klagenfurt has the tower and the lindworm in its coat of arms. Okay, again, I sent you a picture, a photo of the lindworm in Klagenfurt.
How far is this statue from you?
I don't know, maybe a 4-hour drive, probably.
This is absolutely my favorite. I think the lindworm is so stinking cute. Look at him. He's doing a possum face. Oh, totally doing possum face. That's what I call Bean a lot of the time, possum face. She does this like half open. Well, she looks possum face, but look how cute he is. He's like, you know who he reminds me of? Like How to Train Your Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
He's so cute. Oh my goodness, he's so cute. I hate the fact that the guy's hiding a stick behind, like a mace behind his back to beat him with it. Poor lindworm.
And he doesn't look so big.
No, he's...
Like compared to the guy standing next to him.
He doesn't. He really doesn't. He looks roughly the size of a black bear, maybe.
True. Something like that.
How can I get... I want a copy of this statue.
Oh, you can have a copy of this statue, I'm sure. I'm going to look for it. Yeah, definitely.
I need it. I love him. I love him. That's my Patronus.
He has a little bit of crazy eyes, though, don't you think?
He does have crazy eyes. That's specific. That's why I like him so much. It's the possum face and the crazy eyes and the water feature aspect, I think, is nice.
And the wings are not too big.
No, they're not. They're just the right size for a wing. I really like him a lot. You'll see.
All right. So folk tales are not always creepy, scary, or spooky. Sometimes they tell a story about outsmarting a stronger enemy and not a lindworm, but like other humans, right?
Oh, yeah. We're the worst.
Definitely. Like in the case of the next folk tale and the reason why the good people of Salzburg are sometimes referred to as Stierwascher. So bull washers.
Okay.
And the story goes like this. A few hundred years ago, the city of Salzburg was besieged and taken over by a formidable enemy. Those who could sought refuge in the mighty Hohensalzburg fortress, carrying with them whatever livestock and provisions they could gather for the long haul. Hohensalzburg fortress stands tall upon a lofty rock, a beacon of strength against any foe. The enemy soon realized that trying to storm it was like hitting their heads against a brick wall, so they opted for a siege, hoping to starve out the defenders. And it almost worked. Supplies dwindled, bellies growled, and strength waned. Even those sheltered within the fortress began to feel the pangs of hunger, but hope wasn't lost yet. There remained one last white bull, the sole survivor of their livestock. The castle captain pondered whether to slaughter the bull to feed the defenders, perhaps giving them enough strength for one last stand. Yet, he knew deep down it wouldn't make much of a difference. Then, a cunning idea struck him. He ordered the bull to be paraded atop the fortress wall, visible to the enemy below, while being prodded to make it bellow loudly. This wasn't your run-of-the-mill stuffed animal. It was the real deal. As the white bull paced the walls, bellowing with all its might, the castle captain devised his next move. He had the bull painted brown, then paraded it once more. And again, the bull bellowed, this time in a different hue. Finally, it was painted black and marched around the walls, still bellowing as if alive.
Because it was alive.
It was, yeah.
That's the key.
Lo and behold, the besiegers took the bait. They couldn't fed on besieging a fortress with such apparent abundance of living livestock. Because I think the besiegers were they knew that sometimes the people who were in the fortress would try to trick them by, you know, stuffing like hides,
right,
and acting as if they still had livestock. That's why it
exactly
was important that the bull bellowed, yeah.
Yes.
So they couldn't fed on besieging a fortress with such apparent abundance of living livestock. So they packed up and left. When the city folk returned to their homes in Salzburg, they took the black bull to the Salzach River, washed away the black and brown paint, and voila, it was white once more. Word quickly spread of this peculiar tale. The people of Salzburg were dubbed Stierwascher, or bull washers, by those who didn't know the whole story. But those in the know smiled at the jests. After all, there's no shame in outsmarting your enemy to save a fortress full of lives. And thus, around the year 1500, to commemorate this extraordinary event at Hohensalzburg Fortress, an organ was constructed and named the Stier of Salzburg, or Bull of Salzburg. It became a renowned symbol of the city. The white bull was never slaughtered. He lived his final days on Hohensalzburg Fortress, enjoying its well-deserved retirement until it peacefully passed away from old age.
That's good. Is there a bull statue?
I'm actually not quite sure. I'm certain there are quite some rurals in the city of Salzburg commemorating the bull washers. And also, of course, Salzburg City is home of Red Bull. So there
right
are bull signs and such everywhere, I guess.
Yeah.
I think we have time for one last one. This one is from Burgenland and it takes place at the Neusiedler See, so Lake Neusiedl, or in German, Neusiedler See. It's nestled between the borders of Austria and Hungary, spanning across the eastern region of Austria, primarily within the state of Burgenland. This vast body of water covers an area of approximately 315 square kilometers or 122 square miles. Lake Neusiedl is the largest Endorheque, is that the word? In German, it's Binnengewässer. The largest inland body of water with no outflow. I think the word is endorheque in English. I'm not sure.
Ah.
E-N-D-O-R-E-H-E-I-C. Endorheque.
Gotcha. Okay.
So like something left behind by a glacier, not something with a river flowing in and out.
Rivers can flow in, but no outflow. That's, I think, the biggest distinction. It's just the water evaporates.
Got it. Okay.
And that's the biggest one of those in Central Europe. And despite its considerable size and what makes it very unique, the lake's average depth remains very shallow, measuring only about 1.5 meters or 4.9 feet. You can walk almost through the whole lake, yeah.
Wow.
This unique characteristic lends itself to the lake's distinct ecosystem, supporting a diverse array of plant and animal life. The rich biodiversity of Lake Neusiedl and its surrounding wetlands have earned it also the recognition as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The lake serves as a vital habitat for numerous species of birds. During summer, you see a lot of storks there, other birds, many of which are migratory and utilize the area's crucial stopover during their journeys. And among the most notable avian inhabitants are the Eurasian coots, whose population thrive in the lake's shallow waters. Also, Lake Neusiedl serves as a playground for outdoor enthusiasts and nature lovers. Visitors flock to the lake to partake in a variety of recreational activities, including obviously bird watching, sailing, and very popular windsurfing, but also cycling and hiking. Also, what's interesting, the region surrounding the Lake Neusiedl boasts a very rich cultural heritage with a lot of vineyards there and wine production playing a prominent role in its identity. And as a result, the area is very well known for its vineyards and wine production, particularly very sweet or dessert wines, how they are called here. Süßwein.
Nice.
Eiswein.
Is that a good place to spend some time, like to visit?
It's 1000% a nice place to go, especially in spring, fall. Also used to be summer, but unfortunately these days summer can get a wee bit dry. But also you have to be careful because the Neusiedler See is also home to water nymphs, mermaids, and the like. This is how the story goes. Back in the good old days when the lively folk of nymphs and water fairies frolicked in the shimmering waters of Lake Neusiedl and occasionally revealed themselves unexpectedly to the eyes of humans, there lived on the shore of the lake an old, miserly fisherman. Every day he cast his nets into the lake and returned in the evening, laden with a rich catch, to his hut. Selling the fish always brought him good profit, and so he had become a wealthy man over time who had no need to lament loudly over every not fully filled net. But he was insatiable in his greed for profit. Now, as the fish richness, that's like a tongue twister.
Yeah, fish richness.
Now, as the fish richness of the lake gradually declined, he blamed the water fairies for it, accusing them of driving away the fish with their antiques and scolded them with bitter words. One day, he had once again boarded his boat and was rowing along the lake shore. There, he noticed in a bay a graceful being, struggling in vain to get free. As he rowed closer, he recognized a beautiful water nymph. She had become entangled in one of his nets, and in her effort to free herself had torn several holes into it. "Help me out of the net," she pleaded desperately. "For 7 days and 7 nights I have been trapped here and I cannot manage to break free. My children are crying for me." But the fisherman turned a deaf ear to her plea. Furious that the nymph had driven away the fish and torn his net, he struck her down with his fork. As she, with her last strength, cried out to him, "Be cursed for your wicked deed. You shall never see yours again." Then, dying, she sank into the lake. Didn't sink very deep, though.
No, she sank approximately
4 feet.
I mean, slowly though, very slowly.
The fisherman laughed. Suddenly, the lake bottom trembled and a dark night fell. Howling, a raging storm wind swept over the smooth surface of the lake, stirring up mighty waves. The wind carried the fisherman and his boat out into the open lake, where the raging waves closed over the cruel man, never to release him again. On quiet evenings, when the wails of mist cover the whispering reeds of the lake, one can hear a faint splashing and crunching coming from the lake. It's the damned fisherman steering his boat toward the shore with tired hands. But his efforts are in vain. The boat does not budge from his place, and he never succeeds in reaching the saving shore.
Good. That guy was a jerk. I like that
one. Yeah, he was. He deserved what he got.
Yeah.
I always like when these kind of folk tales and fairy tales have like this moral to be not an asshole in life.
Yes, definitely. Like, be a good person.
Okay, I think that's it. But then also, I have a last one for you that's a quick one. And I think I've mentioned this before. I'm sure, Annie, you remember. But for those of you who haven't heard it yet, and I think that fits right in with our macabre fascination in this podcast, why does the Austrian flag look the way it looks? Do you remember, Annie?
I do.
So, to our listeners out there, in case you don't know, the flag of Austria consists of three horizontal stripes of equal width arranged in the colors red, white, and red from top to bottom, or from bottom to top, whatever. It's the same. Doesn't matter. And the legend says that it came from the time of the Crusades. To be exact, it has to do with the siege of Akkon, or the siege of Acre, or known as the siege of Akko, or the siege of Saint-Jean d'Acre. This was a very significant event during the Third Crusade. It took place from 28th of August 1189 to 12th of July 1191, when the Crusader forces, led primarily by King Guy of Jerusalem, Richard the Lionheart of England, and Holy Roman Emperor Frederick I Barbarossa, laid siege to the city of Acre, or modern-day Akko in Israel, which was held by the Muslim forces, primarily under Saladin. The siege lasted for nearly 2 years and was marked by intense fighting, disease, and starvation on both sides. The Crusaders faced numerous challenges, including the need to maintain a supply line across the Mediterranean Sea, while Saladin's forces struggled with internal divisions and shortages of food and water. Despite setbacks and internal conflicts among the Crusaders, Acre eventually fell to the Christian forces on 12th of July 1191 after a prolonged and brutal siege. The victory of Acre was a very pivotal moment in the Third Crusade, as it allowed the Crusaders to establish a foothold in the Holy Land, and it basically paved the way for further advances against Saladin's forces. If you listen to our episodes about the Habsburg tragedies in the first part, then you might remember that before the Habsburger, the Babenberger family ruled Austria. They were actually the first dukes of Austria. And Leopold V, Duke of Austria, also took part in the siege of Acre during the Crusades in 1191. The Babenberg is said to have fought so fiercely that his white tunic was stained red with the blood of his enemies. And after the battles, when Leopold's sword belt was finally removed, only a single white stripe remained in the middle of the blood-red tunic. Since the Austrian Duke's actual banner was lost during the battle, or stolen by King Richard the Lionheart of England, Emperor Henry VI reportedly allowed the Babenberg to use the red-white-red colors as his new banner from then on. The thing with Richard the Lionheart is a whole other story. Leopold was actually pretty pissed that Richard had taken his banner and allegedly had dragged it through the mud to mock Leopold. And I think I told that story in the episode about the Stephansdom.
It's such a good story, though. It's such a good origin story of a flag.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have our teeny tiny country. Well, now teeny tiny. We weren't always teeny tiny.
No. You were an empire once.
I hope you enjoyed most of these stories or all of these stories.
I enjoyed all of them.
There are so many more.
Thank you so much for telling me these amazing stories.
People out there, when you come to Vienna, you have to do this kind of... I'm sure there are tours going to all these places where the famous sagen took place, like the Basilisk House. You can still see that one. The Bogner wife's house basically still exists, but I don't think you can see anything there, but there is a lot of good stuff. A lot of good stuff. I'm going to take a sip of water. Do you have something good?
I do. This whole episode I enjoyed so much. And two things I was reminded of during this episode. One is when you were talking about the Bogner's wife and you said, this is for all the wicked women out there. And I immediately got the lyric, the new Taylor Swift album came out. And I wouldn't say I'm a Swiftie per se. Like, I've never been to a concert. I don't own any merch. But I like a lot of her music a lot. And I cannot get the lyric, I leap from the gallows and I levitate down your street, out of my head. It's just such a good lyric. And I'm loving the whole aesthetic for the Fortnite video. But I'm also, God, this is an update where you find out how basic I am. But right now I'm also reading the Sarah J. Maas. It's the, let's see, I want to make sure I tell you the right, everybody probably knows what I'm talking about. It's a Court of Thorns and Roses series, and it's kind of fairy stuff. But just all the talk of, like,
nymphs and worms and bitey things that live in the basement of the library. I'm only on book three, so no spoilers, but I'm enjoying it very much at the moment. It's been a good, like, read in bed while I'm recovering series. That's it. How about you? What's good?
I would say my something good this week is Austria and Vienna. And I know I often bitch about how I prefer living in the countryside, but Vienna is a beautiful city. Vienna has an absolute rich history, rich tradition, rich culture. Well, whole of Austria does. And sometimes I don't say how much I appreciate it. I don't say it enough, maybe, but it is. And I can only recommend to everybody who's like thinking about visiting, come visit. You're gonna enjoy it. We have a lot of beautiful sites, a lot of beautiful nature, a lot of Burgen and Schlösser.
I can't wait to see the Burgen and Schlösser.
Also, I bought a new dirndl. Well, actually, I bought a used dirndl because now living in the countryside, sometimes, you know, you have these kind of events where a dirndl is always fitting.
It looks so good on you.
Thank you. I didn't want to spend like 200 euros or more on a dirndl on that I wear like twice a year. So I was actually looking on the secondhand pages and I found one because there are beautiful dirndl out there that are very ornate and very like for going to a wedding. But I wanted something more simple that I can wear, you know, dress up or dress down.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just switch the apron or switch the blouse under it. And I found one that was originally, it would cost like 150 euros and I paid 23 euros and it fits like a glove and it's amazing.
It looks amazing.
Speaking of gloves, on 16th of May.
That's a nice transition.
It is, right? And I didn't even plan
girl.
It. On 16th of May, 8 o'clock, anytime or next morning, 2 a.m. Johanna time, we're doing the Patreon Murder Tier get-together about O.J. Simpson this time. So if you're in the Murder Tier, don't miss it. But don't worry, if you can't make it with our new system, you can rewatch it later on.
Please also, when you see that update with the information and the link and everything, write your comments. Tell us your thoughts.
Yeah.
Like, what do you want to say? So if you're not there, we can still converse with you.
Exactly.
Please. Please also, if you would, this was an amazing episode. So please do me a huge favor and leave a 5-star review for us somewhere, wherever you can, to tell Johanna how amazing she is and what a nice story time that was for all of us. Also, you can tell people when people are like, hey, I need something to listen to. You know what? Listen to Fresh Hell. Oh, you know what I listen to when I vacuum? Fresh Hell. You know, spread the word. Tell your friends about us. Talk about us at the nail salon. Tell your doctor. Tell your phlebotomist. They always want to listen to murder shows, at least in my experience. Also, thank you to all the phlebotomists out there for doing the work you do. But yeah, just spread the word, please. What else, Johanna?
Yes, that helps the most. For everything else, go visit our webpage, freshhellpodcast.com. There you'll find the link to Patreon, to the merch store, to our email address, which is freshhellpodcast@gmail.com, to our PO box. And that's it. Please tell your pets, your basilisk, your lindworm, your water nymph, whatever you have at home. Hug them, cuddle them, take them to the vet, to the cryptozoology vet. I'm going to give an update about Jem pretty soon. We're
Good.
Still waiting on some results.
No news yet, right? Yeah.
Next week, probably. And
okay.
Be kind to your pets. Be kind to your water nymphs. Don't beat them with your oars. Don't beat the lindworm to death with some, I don't even know what it was.
I want a lindworm
clubs,
so
sticks,
bad. I can't
stones.
Even tell you. Wait till you guys see the picture of the statue. You'll know what I mean. I'm dying. It's
I'm going to
so
get
cute.
You one and send you one.
I really want one.
Be kind to your fellow human being, unless they are fishermen assholes who beat innocent creatures.
That's right.
To death. And be kind to yourself. That's the hardest part of it all.
Yeah. Stop being mean to yourself. It bums me out. And if you're going through hell,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye-bye.